This time on the Plutopia podcast, our evil alien overlords, John and Scoop, talk about their favorite science fiction films and TV series. We do.
The Theme from Another World was made in 1951. It was directed by a guy named Christian Nyby, but it was really kind of the force behind it was Howard Hawks. And they wanted to make a science fiction film. And they had this story, Who Goes There? But at the time, it was very daunting to shoot the story exactly as it had been written, especially the shapeshifter part. There was a limit to the kind of effects they could have, and ultimately they created, or they included an alien that was very much a humanoid.
You know, the whole subtext of the alien was communism. That's what you were supposed to figure that out. A lot of the critics pointed out that it was a drama that points out the evil of communism being an alien thing.
We're going to talk about science fiction tonight.
That's an easy one because I've been addicted to it forever, and you obviously have been as well.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it quite a bit lately. My most recent big screen science fiction experience, other than things I've been watching on the smaller television screen, I actually have a very large television, like flat screen too, so I guess that counts. But I saw the IMAX version of Dune 2, the latest Dune film by Denis Villeneuve, and it was a fairly amazing experience. I thought it was exceptionally well done. It kind of knocked my socks off. And of course, thinking a little bit about Frank Herbert, you know, and the world that he created. I mean, he was a great world builder. Frank Herbert, of course, being the author of the original Dune books, Dune, and then what, Children of Dune, Dune Messiah. There was a series of those books, and I think, I believe that one of his kids started writing sequels too. Anyway, Dune takes place on it's in the far future on a planet far away. And the assumption is that space travel has developed to the extent that many worlds have been colonized, particularly a planet called Arrakis, where there is a form of spice, and this spice is somewhat hallucinogenic and much in demand. So the spice trade is a pretty big deal. And one of the key aspects of this Dune story is the colonization of the planet Arrakis to take the spice and sell it. Colonization by other planets in the universe. And of course, there's like an empire, there's an emperor that is somewhat distant. And in this new Dune film, Dune 2, the emperor is played by Christopher Walken.
That's an emperor there.
Yeah, he was quite good, yeah.
When the 1984 film came out, the whole thing about the spice was pointed out as being kind of taking the place of LSD, and the weird beings that came in to collect on their their spice, they were kind of supposed to be the drug dealers. And that was a little simplistic, but it was an interesting way they presented all of the spice and the whole thing that spice was doing for and to those worlds.
And it's typically consumed, spice was a fairly mild hallucinogen, but there is this product called the water of life, and they show in this film, they show how the water of life is made, and it's basically extracted from a sandworm as a very concentrated liquid form of the hallucinogenic substance that is also in spice in milder forms. And the word is that, so there's the Ben Gesserit order of women who are, they have kind of exceptional powers. And part of the thing about being a Ben Gesserit is that
I thought you were Ben Gazzara.
Ben Gazzara, yeah. I have trouble with the pronunciation of that, but there is this water of life which you can take to become a reverend mother as a member of the Ben Gesserit, and it's, no male is supposed to be able to survive taking the water of life. Though there is a prophecy that one will come who will take the water of life, a male, and will become the Kwisatz-Haderach, who is like, you know, the chosen one who will rule over all, whatever. And of course, that's our protagonist in Yunfu. I guess I'm kind of throwing out spoilers here, and I probably shouldn't be. But I have a sense that a lot of people who have been seeing the film, the first and second Dune films, and the older Dune film that David Lynch made, and that there was a miniseries too on Sci-Fi Channel of Dune, and people I think have read the novel, and it's not that you go for surprises, you just go for the experience, to experience the story as an audiovisual and somewhat immersive in the case of this IMAX presentation. Oh my God. I mean, you were kind of in the thing, and the soundtrack particularly was very powerful. But this is like the essence of science fiction, is this kind of world building, and it's a future world, but there's characteristics of it that are sort of like, you know, like feudal times, you know. So it's kind of like the past and kind of like the future. And it's like a whole different kind of world. And that's one form of science fiction that can be very powerful. What do you think, Scoop?
Yeah. What I got from the first film was it was very Arabic, almost, you know, it was like an Arabic culture, and
yeah,
at the time that was really cool. Now it, you know, might be taken in a whole different way by certain parties, you know, who are anti-Arab anything, you know, we know what his name is, but it was interesting. The first film was really interesting. It got bad reviews from a lot of the usual, film critics. But I actually enjoyed it because it was just different. You know, David Lynch was, you know, notorious for coming up with things really different. whether it was that or, you know, his TV productions. You know, it was a bit psychedelic just in its whole structure and the way it presented everything about that culture on the planet. And I enjoyed, I'm not a big fan of remakes. I'm one of those old guys who's like, why remake something? If it really sucked, that might be a reason for remaking. But a lot of the sci-fi stuff that they started remaking, it seemed like it just, they didn't have any other original concepts. So let's just take this one and rebake it and make it our own. And I don't really care for that. Some people do, you know, like the, you know, the version 2.0 or 3.0, but yeah, I'd rather have writers going out and finding new concepts rather than taking an old one and reheating it and trying to bring it out again.
Well, I do think that in the era of, well, at the level of sophisticated filmmaking that we have now, and the fact that we have CGI and can create such realistic effects, that it did kind of make sense to remake Dune, and that they were able to do it with a much larger budget. I mean, it's just a huge enterprise. I mean, here we are, we have two films so far, and the third one, and there's going to be a third called Dune Messiah, which was also the name of one of the books. But you make a good point, and this takes me to one of the other stories and films that I wanted to talk about, and that is The Thing, which originally is based on a story that was that appeared in I think it was 1934 in Astounding Science Fiction under the name, no, it was 1938, I'm sorry, and it was supposedly written by Don A. Stewart, which was a pseudonym for John W. Campbell, who was a well-known science fiction writer and became the editor of Analog Science Fiction, which was a pretty famous science fiction magazine, which I assume still exists.
Yeah, it was one of my favorites when it first coming out.
And you know, this story he had written so long ago was pretty, for you know, it was a pretty interesting story. I think it was inspired a little bit by I'm drawing a blank. H.P. Lovecraft. I'm trying to remember the name of I can't remember the name. There was a story that Lovecraft wrote that I read, which means it's terrible that I'm drawing a blank, but it took place in Antarctica. And, it's as per Lovecraft's usual, it was a horror story, and it involved Cthulhu and, you know, the race from another planet and Lovecraft's famous xenophobia. But so I think that there was a little bit of inspiration there. Who Goes There was about an alien who has crashed in the Arctic region, and he's sort of dug out of the ice. The ice melts, the alien escapes, the alien in that story is a shapeshifter. So the question is, do you ever know whether the guy sitting next to you is actually the alien or not? Because the alien can assume various forms. Now, when The Thing from Another World was made in 1951, it was directed by a guy named Christian Nyby, but it was really kind of the force behind it was Howard Hawks, who, like Christian Nyby, had been an editor for Howard Hawks. So Hawks got him to direct this movie, but Hawks was kind of involved too. And they wanted to make a science fiction film. And they had this story, Who Goes There? But at the time, it was very daunting to shoot the story exactly as it had been written, especially the shapeshifter part. There was a limit to the kind of effects they could have, and ultimately they created, or they included an alien that was very much a humanoid, though in fact he was a vegetable. And he was played by James Arness, you know, Matt Dillon.
Dillon.
And but the point I was going to make is that so this is a really great film. I love The Thing from Another World. I've watched it over and over again. And one of the things I really love about it is the attitude of the people who are trying to fight with, you know, and take down this alien in the Arctic. It's a combination of military people and scientists. And one of the scientists who is like the leader of the scientific expedition there has gone a little nuts and is, you know, he doesn't want to harm the alien, even though the alien clearly is ready to harvest all of the humans and use their blood to grow more aliens.
You know, the whole subtext of the thing, of the alien, was communism. You were supposed to figure that out. That was the thing in that year was, you know, the McCarthy, you know, campaigns were going crazy of, you know, everybody was a commie that he didn't care for. And that was just a good, you know, cheap shot there. But a lot of the critics pointed out that it was a drama that points out the evil of communism being an alien thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the thing about it was the humor of those people. I mean, they're cracking jokes. It's like, so Hawks had been, you know, he had been involved with the military and he had spent a lot of time with military people, and he kind of wanted to show how military people work under pressure and how the ideal of military leadership would work, like Captain Hendry in this story. And I've told people many times that I think that this is a great film to show as a team building exercise, because it really shows you how a team can work under pressure. You know, it, part of the film is that it sees science as potentially misguided, not science in general, but it shows they have this one character who is sort of like ignoring the fact that the alien just wants to drain his blood and grow more aliens, because he wants that knowledge, you know, he wants to be able to study the alien. And the other scientists are like, well, I'm not so sure about that. But it's the military guys who actually manage to find a way to ultimately, you know, deal with the alien. And then there's that famous bit at the end where the reporter is finally able to make his report, and he's saying, "Watch the skies, watch the skies."
You know, it's interesting your mentioning of the team building, because you know, this movie influenced a lot of movies that would come later. You know, especially in science fiction and animated science fiction too, picked up on that. There was an interesting episode of the cartoon classic Futurama, in which they had the entire team of the spaceship was going to have a team building exercise, and they brought in a guy who was your typical team building guru, and he brought in a alien being who turned out to be a shapeshifter. And yeah, you could see the thing painted all over that script, but you would see that in a lot of, you know, especially the cheaper monster movies. They drew heavily upon the whole thing. It's the evil thing that changes and that wants to take over the world. But when I saw, you know, the thing, it was I was a kid. It was frightening. You know, it made me think, well, geez, what if those commies really are alien beings from outer space? And they're like, no, that's not right.
Well, it was scary for the time. They did a good job of building suspense and frightening you. But one of the points I wanted to make is kind of getting back to your point about remakes. So this was remade by John Carpenter in, what was it, like 1981 or 82? And Carpenter wanted to make the story who goes there. I mean, he wanted to actually film the story that Campbell had written, or closer to it. And he could do it because the effects technology had advanced so much since 1951. You know, it's like 30 years later, they can do remarkable special effects. They're not at the point of having CGI yet. Well, maybe so. Maybe there was some CGI used in that film. I'm not sure exactly how far back we can go. Generally, what we think of CGI as having really got its start with Jurassic Park, but there might have been some computer animation before that. I can't swear that there wasn't. But point is that Carpenter was able to make a reasonably budgeted science fiction film, and to have some actually pretty weird and gory effects that showed that were, you know, were about the alien doing his shape-shifting thing, and I don't know, it's a classic in itself. So both of those versions of the thing are really classics for different reasons.
Yeah, the
And
one
the carp, oh,
yeah,
go ahead.
Carpenter Wharton had a budget of like $200,000 for the effects, and they figured out that was not going to work, and they ended up, I think it says, they spent $750,000 on special effects, and
Which was probably a lot at the time.
at that time, that was $750,000 was pretty big. I mean, in today's money, I'm not sure what that would be, but it was a sizable budget for a 1980s movie. So he did a good job.
And this also gets to the breadth of science fiction that we talked earlier about Dune, which is this like huge sophisticated world building exercise. You know, the one of the great novels of science fiction, but there's also these just alien invasion pieces, you know, that no world building involved. You just have an alien who comes to Earth in some form, and you have to deal with them. Predator is a pretty classic example of that.
Well, you know,
And oh, go ahead.
one thing I like about certain, scary movies is the lack of special effects. As an example, the 1962 film, The Manchurian Candidate, scared the crap out of me. It was, speculating about whether, evil forces from, they were, basically saying Russia and China were going to be turning people into robot killers, basically. They would be brainwashed into going out and, in this movie, killing, the president, or, people that wanted to become president. And when I saw that, it scared the crap out of me, because you could see in the news, I was just starting to pay attention to the news. You could see that there was that sort of thing going on. And as it turned out, the CIA had the MK Ultra program, where they were feeding people LSD and other chemicals to try to make them into controlled beings. So, maybe they watched the Manchurian Candidate and took it to heart.
Yeah, I mean, what if some foreign power groomed some basically kind of a stooge and managed to manipulate the information environment to nudge things along to eventually get this guy elected president? Their stooge is president.
Gee, and
That would be frightening, wouldn't it?
kind of familiar, doesn't it? And speaking of stooges killing presidents, that was one of the big things in the JFK assassination, the various conspiracy theories, and that was one of them, that it was either Castro ordering the killing or the Russians ordering it. There's so many conspiracy theories, but they all reek heavily of science fiction.
Well, I wonder, aliens had him killed. Is that possible? I was just wondering if aliens were responsible.
You just never know. Define aliens. I mean, that's a word that's being bandied about a lot. You know, there's illegal aliens, there's space aliens, there's God knows what.
You know, I have heard a theory that that Kennedy was killed because he was about to disclose the truth about UFOs.
Well,
that's kind of a science fictional theory. I mean, it's dumb as hell, but it's kind of, you know, weirdly science fictional.
Yeah, the conspiracy theories that I've found to be more believable, having been living in that area, was all about Dallas, the power structure in Dallas, the politics in Dallas. It was a very scary conservative place.
That's science fiction.
Yeah. And you didn't need science fiction. You go to Dallas and you're living it.
Well, actually, what we know now, having watched the X-Files, is that it was the cigarette smoking man who pulled the trigger.
The cigarette smoking man. Yeah, the X-Files. Now I have a lot of favorite, you know, sci-fi TV things, but my taste, you know, one of the reasons I would indulge in sci-fi from an early age was just to disconnect from whatever my life was at that time and be entertained. And so I found great, funny and weird sci-fi series, two of them, Red Dwarf and Cowboy Bebop. Anime series that I just loved every episode of it, and it was totally out there. And it's just you can still watch it, and it really holds up well. Yeah, all these years later. And see, it came out when did it come out? In 1999, and it was originally a Japanese production of TV Tokyo, and it ended up being dubbed into English. And when it was dubbed into English, they started showing it on PBS stations in the Bay Area. And that's where I got hooked. And I went out and immediately tried to find VHS of them, and they didn't even have it yet because it was really only on tape in Japan. But now I have all sorts of copies of the various Cowboy Bebop episodes. But
that's a good time for me to bring this up.
Ah, there's another character there.
Yeah, Totoro. But Totoro is not really, I wouldn't say it's science fiction. I think it's more like fantasy. But it's definitely like, we talked about world building, like with Dune or whatever. So Totoro has a kind of surreal world where there are creatures. In fact, this is common with Hayao Miyazaki to include creatures that, it's like magical realism, blending sort of magical elements with realistic elements. And he's created some very powerful films that way. But I wouldn't call them science fiction. And that really, it gets to one point, is that I noticed early on, like years ago, I used to go to science fiction conventions, specifically ArmadilloCon, which is a venerable science fiction convention. It's been happening for years here in Austin. They still do it every year. And one thing I found was that it wasn't science fiction exclusively, but it was also fantasy. And it troubled me at the time. I thought, there's really a difference here. I mean, if you're going to have a science fiction convention, it ought to be about science fiction. And if you want to talk, have a fantasy thing, you should do it elsewhere. But I really came to understand that the things that drew people to science fiction also drew them to fantasy, and that the two were intermingled somewhat. In fact, in talking about science fiction, they would use the term hard science fiction to describe science fiction that's really science fiction, that's really fiction about science, you know?
It's all about the nuts and bolts of real sciencey stuff. But a lot of people who love fantasy and science fiction point out that perhaps the Lord of the Rings was science fiction, but it's talking about the science of this imaginary place. And they have all sorts of concepts that are kind of sciencey if if you suspend your disbelief there. And a lot of fantasy things might be considered science fiction, but I agree. There's some things it's just it's total fantasy, and there's nothing that is related to science. But you can kind of look at the people that like both, and I can understand how they can kind of consider it all the same.
Well, Arthur C. Clarke is famous for having said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So magic is really just a technology, right? A form of technology.
A lot.
And science fiction is about technology.
Yeah, well, people who are really into the whole magic scene, look at it as that. It's got, in scientific procedures, you have a list of things, procedures you have to follow. And that's not that different from the way magic spells are laid out in a lot of the magical realm. It's like you've got a spell that you need newt's eyeballs and that sort of thing. So it's a little sciencey. So there's a lot of bleeding through of the both of them.
That's kind of hard too, because I mean, with Newt Gingrich, he's only got two eyeballs. How many can you actually expect to get and use?
Well, let's find out. Let's go find
Yeah,
track him down, see if he'll spare an eyeball. We might be able to come up with a nice po political spell.
there's another movie that I want to be sure and talk about that's kind of an alien invasion movie, but of a real different kind, is The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, yes.
And it was based on a book, not a book, but actually a short story called Farewell to the Master by a guy named Harry Bates. And in the movie, Klaatu, the alien, comes to Earth to basically deliver a message. And the message is, and he wants to meet with the world leaders to do this, which turns out to be politically very difficult. But he wants to deliver the message, which is that we're watching you and you're starting to use atomic weapons, and monkeys with atomics have us worried. So we just want to let you know to chill with the atomics, I guess. Now, in the actual short story, the interesting thing about it is that, so Klaatu has a robot with him named Gort, and Gort seems to be like an intelligent kind of servant, basically, that does as instructed by Klaatu. But in the movie, you learn that Gort is actually the master and not Klaatu. I mean, I'm sorry, in the short story. That was in the story, but they didn't carry it over to the film. But it was an influential film at the time. It was a very well done film by Robert Wise, was a pretty great film director. He actually directed West Side Story and several other high quality films. But he got his start working with Val Lewton. Do you know who Val Lewton was?
Not really.
Well, he was a producer who specialized in horror movies. And a couple of his famous films were The Cat People and then Curse of the Cat People, which was kind of a sequel to Cat People. So they were really horror movies and kind of fantasy. Actually, Curse of the Cat People is kind of a more kind of fantastic, kind of a beautifully done fantasy. And they were all very low budget movies that were extremely well done. And he was sort of like Roger Corman in that he had a lot of directors working with him that developed their craft working with him on these low budget movies and then went on to make more significant films later. And Wise was one of those. And The Day the Earth Stood Still it was like a black and white film, and it was it had a reasonable budget. I don't think it had a huge budget. It had a pretty realistic flying saucer in it, you know, that landed, that Plateau came to Earth in. But it was not about, scary stuff. I mean, if anything, it was about how scary humans are and how aliens would perceive us as being pretty frightening. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's an alien teleprompter. So
I have often wondered how that's translated, Barada Nikto.
Well, you know, there was a band called Klaatu that was...
Yeah.
It was a big hoax, basically. They were all being rumored as being the Beatles, you know, doing a anonymous project, and turned out it was just a bunch of Canadian musicians who came up with the name, and you know, people guessed who the band was, and they just got let it roll and got all sorts of free publicity out of Klaatu. I actually have their album somewhere.
And they were Beatlesque, weren't they? Their music sounded a little like the Beatles, didn't it?
I didn't really hear it, but people thought it was. Yeah, I'm a real Beatles fan, so I caught on to that and immediately just went, no, that is not them. They're not that good.
A Canadian rock group, John Walashuk and D. Long and Terry Draper. Yeah. Named themselves after Ambassador Klaatu from an extraterrestrial confederation who visits Earth with his companion robot Gort in the film The Day the Earth Stood Still. Apparently they didn't do all that well.
No, but they did get enough free publicity to where they at least got their, you know, their 15 minutes of fame.
Well, that, you know, that an interesting point there about science fiction and music. I think science fiction has had a lot of influence on music. And one thing that I ran across the other day on YouTube, a documentary about the Barons. Hold on. Well, I can't find it. Anyway, it was B.B. and Lewis Barron were the people who created the soundtrack for Forbidden Planet. And everybody was sort of astonished that the soundtrack they were creating was accepted because it was so incredibly strange. It was just a brilliant electronic music soundtrack. And there was a whole thing about how, you know, they were basically building all kinds of machines that would generate these electronic sounds, and they had a lot of trouble sustaining them. I mean, they would kind of like they'd create a sound and then the thing would kind of blow up or fall apart or something like that. But that was kind of an amazing soundtrack. And those soundtracks of science fiction films have been occasionally pretty interesting. That was one case. The other one was 2001, A Space Odyssey.
That was a great soundtrack.
It was a great soundtrack. And originally, Alex North had been commissioned and had written a soundtrack for the film, and Kubrick decided he didn't want to use it. Instead, he pulled together music, mostly classical music, some fairly surreal classical music to use in the film. I'm a huge fan of 2001, and when it first came out, people would ask me what it meant. You know, I guess they thought I might have some, that I was weird enough that I might understand the film. And I would usually give them an explanation that was probably pretty much bogus. But I've been thinking about it lately. I'm actually working on writing something about 2001. And one of the first things I was thinking about was how, you know, I sort of took for granted, it was like accepted the Kubrick's idea of what the early like Australopithecine apes, prehumans were like, but he made them like pretty coarse, not very nuanced, you know, and it could be that they were quite a bit different from the way that he presented them. And then what he showed was that there was a kind of catalyzation by this alien presence, like the big monolith that appeared where the apes were. And what did that do? That started a process of the development of an intelligence that would evolve into human intelligence. But the way that he presents that intelligence, he shows that that the first manifestation of that intelligence is that they start making tools or using objects as tools. But then quickly they start using objects as weapons.
Yeah, so that kind of goes with the whole, you know, being kind of rough and you know, it was a work, you know, humans were a work in progress apparently, and some of the progress was not that great, weapons being one thing. And I just loved the way the intro there was interesting, of going from the bone weapon being tossed up in the air and morphing into the space station. And that was just a,
it was the evolution of technology. It was a great way to show it visually.
But, you know, the whole thing, I knew a lot of people who really didn't like the film because they thought it was boring, because it was slow. And
mm-hmm.
That's one thing I liked about it. You know, interesting. Quite often aren't really all jazzed up and full of energy. It's a slow process. And I just liked the way they unfolded the story, you know, gradually, but it all ended up making sense because they were able to, I'm able to lose my voice here. Anyway, aliens have taken my voice, John. But I brought
it's the allergies. They're getting me too. He said.
Yeah, that was my antidote there. But, you know, I think the soundtracks had a lot to do with the success of some of Star Wars. Benefited greatly, you know, with John Williams and all those guys.
Yeah.
And the guys that did the sounds for Star Wars. Yeah. A friend of mine got to meet the guy that was the real, you know, sound that created all those effects and, you know, in the audio track. And they put a lot of work into it, and it really made a difference, you know, rather than just the usual sounds you would hear in sci-fi movies. They came out with some interesting ones, like this one here.
What?
Anyway.
Was I supposed to hear something?
You didn't hear that?
I didn't hear anything.
Oh.
Did you do a sound share?
I don't know why the microphone would not pick that up. I'm holding this thing right here, right in front of
me. Oh.
It's got digitized Star Wars effects, like this one is.
Oh, I heard that.
So anyway, things like that became part.
What was that? Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
No, this is We're Doomed. That's
We're Doomed.
That's C-3PO being a coward, basically.
Well, that was John Williams that did that soundtrack, and it was a great sweeping soundtrack. He did several of those. And he was definitely in demand for science fiction films. I guess he did all of the Star Wars films. And what do we have? We have like 9 films now, and they're talking about making more. And we have a whole set of like television series that are in the Star Wars universe. Have you been watching those?
Which ones?
Like The Mandalorian is a good example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or The Book of Boba Fett.
Yeah, I've watched all of those, and they're really well done. It's interesting. It's, you know, it's just a different take on different things from the original stories. You know, take one piece and go off and make it into a series, which, as long as the series is well done, I'm all for it. There's some who don't like it, but...
I was a big fan of The Mandalorian and pretty much all of those things.
Yeah.
And I noticed that there were several directors. For instance, Jon Favreau really kind of became the prime mover with The Mandalorian. He was writing and directing all of those.
Yeah, he seems to have a real talent for that kind of filmmaking, because anything I've seen his name on was something I really generally appreciated.
And interestingly, Ronnie Howard's daughter, Bryce Dallas Howard, was directing some of those episodes.
Oh, interesting.
As well, some of The Mandalorian and I think, let's see, what was this series with Rosario Dawson?
Oh, that's,
I can't
Ahsoka? Is that it?
Ahsoka, yeah.
I
think Bryce Dallas Howard did some of those too.
Yeah, Rosario Dawson is incredible anyway.
Yeah, that was a pretty fine spinoff, I guess, from Star Wars. And she is, as far as I know, the only female Jedi I take it back. Because there's a female Jedi in the latest Star Wars, the Daisy Ridley character.
Leia was supposedly a bit of a Jedi at the end of all the movies. There, she was, you know, she was able to go.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Space and bring herself back. So that's pretty good Jedi trick there.
But there was Rey, who was like the protagonist of the latest Star Wars movies. And yeah, she was definitely...
That's a good character, too. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, skilled Jedi.
Another movie by you, and it'll be one of those, is it science fiction or not? Clockwork Orange.
And yeah.
They had an interesting soundtrack. Wendy Carlos, formerly Walter Carlos, did the electronic... soundtrack of that, plus they had a lot of, you know, kind of classical touches, just like in the 2001 soundtrack.
Yeah, and both were Kubrick.
Yeah, and I went to a premiere of that when that first came out, and people walked out of there going, "What the hell did I just see?" Some people were offended, and some people just, you know, like me, just loved it because it was totally off the wall. Yeah, Kubrick was the master of off the wall, I guess.
It was violent.
Oh, very.
It was a level of violence that people were not accustomed to, yeah. Especially in a quality, you know, film.
Yeah, and it was a bit of a sermon on is violence good? Is it bad? What is violence?
I guess it got what you would refer to as mixed reviews.
Yeah, yeah. I've always found the reviews interesting because when you look at the new reviews of some movies that got panned by the usual suspects, it gives you an interesting comparison of how different people, different generations perceive the same product. And there are a lot of people, anything that is vaguely boomer related, gets dissed these days. And with the okay boomer, I don't watch your movie.
We had some pretty great movies, boomers did.
We had some pretty horrible ones too. Let's go watch Xanadu.
It was kind of interesting to just kind of look at that whole scene of like the directors that emerged in the 70s and 80s. And I'm thinking about Spielberg and George Lucas and Coppola. And there was a real interest in science fiction. Of course, Spielberg made some great science fiction films, especially Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was a favorite of mine.
That is a great example because that's really impacted the culture at the time. The cultural references were cropping up all around that movie. People were going around making little sculptures of Devil's Tower out of their mashed potatoes. I actually did that. Pissed my daughter.
I'm going to go make some mashed potatoes right now.
Well, but
you know, there's one other thing I wanted to be sure to mention since we're running out of time, and that is new television series, Three Body Problem, based on the Cixin Liu novels.
I haven't caught that yet, but it's on my to-do list.
It's a pretty amazing thing to watch. It's very kind of surreal and spacey, I thought. And it covers a lot of ground. But the basic premise is that aliens are, that we've sent a message to aliens that we never should have sent. But, you know, somebody who is disgusted with the human race, in China, there was a project to try to detect signals from alien intelligences, sort of like SETI, right? And a message finally does come through, but we get a message saying, "I am a pacifist, but other members of my race will invade you if they detect your message. And so far they haven't detected it, so you should chill." Mm-hmm. You know, basically warning us to not send any more messages. And the person who intercepts that message is a woman who is like a Chinese scientist who is pretty disgusted with the human race, so she sends the message.
She
basically invites them to invade the planet.
Come on.
Only
man.
It's going to take them 400 years to get here. So we've got 400 years to figure it out, right? But they have figured out how to communicate with people on Earth immediately, like without lag, without the 400 or the lag that, I mean, they're so distant that there would normally be a lag there, but There was something about bouncing a signal off the sun or whatever. Well, anyway,
that's a concept that's been used in a lot of different science fiction related things, of the people 1,000 years out who, or 1,000 light years out, who are just now getting our first TV transmissions or radio transmissions. That's been used. That's popped up in a lot of things that I've seen in recent years. And that's a concept that, it's similar to Contact, which was the movie where they got the instructions to build the travel or whatever kind of machine that was. It was, you know, hidden in what was it, a video of Hitler. That was one of the first TV transmissions, and they sent it back to us so we can build our spaceship or space whatever that thing was.
Yeah, Contact was pretty interesting. The thing that that struck me most about that was that the interaction of the Tom Skerritt character with Jodie Foster's character, you know, the way, as it was like typical academic bullshit, you know, the more tenured professor basically steals the work from the less tenured professor. And in this case, it's like him taking the project from her. She's like worked on it all along, and she's definitely set the whole thing up to actually make the contact. And then he steps in and takes over basically, and it's going to do it. But then I can't recall, something happened, he got killed or something, and she actually did end up being the one to make contact. Yeah. I haven't seen that in a while. That's just, yeah, I have vague memories of that.
That guy that is involved as well, our favorite UT cheerleader.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was a religious figure of some kind in that film.
He was a not really a Bible thumper, but he was a religious theoretician, I guess, is what he was.
Yeah.
All right. But if we do another one of these, we've got to talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once. I just want to watch that again and still keep finding things in that movie.
Yeah, that was that was definitely science fiction, I guess. It's the multidimensional. There's a lot of science fiction that leverages this concept of multiple dimensions. They get intertwined in some way, you know, people hopping around. There's actually one of the things I wanted to talk about was Constellation, which is and we don't really have time to get into it too much, but it was a series on Apple television that's just about that. You know, it's about multiple dimensions and people getting swapped from one to the other. That's one part of the story anyway.
Yeah, and then that's a concept that I've seen in a lot of different movie and TV science fiction, is the alternate universe. And that's made for a lot of interesting film, but it also makes for some bullshit theories. There are a lot of people out there who are trying to get over to that other universe, like, well, good luck, Skippy. send us a postcard when you get there.
The other thing I was going to talk about is the book that I'm reading right now, Termination Shock by Neal Stephenson, which is a climate change sci-fi novel. But I don't have time to talk about it because we have reached the end.
Okay, well, everybody go out and read some sci-fi, watch some sci-fi, write some. We'll watch it.
And we'll talk about it again.
We're easy.
I think this is a great subject for us.
Hey, it's easy. Stuff we've been doing for most of our life is reading sci-fi.
Go ahead. Right on. Absolutely.
Thanks, John.
All right. I'll see ya.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network. 20 minutes, into the future.